This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal, and we're still talking about speed cameras and the lack thereof, and the replacements that the Ford government has been touting and that are challenging Olivia Chow's management skills. Now, as we've been reporting, the province has sent signs, very large plywood signs, about 3 feet wide and 7 or 8 feet tall to replace the cameras. Now Mayor Chow is complaining that she needs new poles and that the province had promised to pay for them. And that has the transport minister really annoyed, and he's saying, gee, I think Toronto should be able to handle putting up some signs. Meanwhile, there's a bigger problem, and that is that these huge signs may create blind spots that make it hard to see the small children that they are intended to protect. And over in Brampton, a city councillor is saying that there's already evidence of more speeding since the cameras became illegal a week ago. So in Brampton, the cameras are still operating. They're just not issuing tickets. And they have detected a pickup in speeding since they became illegal. But I guess they're saying the good news is that when people are speeding now, they're speeding at less speeds, at slower speeds than they were speeding before. So, I don't know, all of it looks like a really silly mess. And I will also continue my ranting about how hard it is to get city councillors, especially here in Toronto, to respond to everyday practical matters that interest the residents and businesses, like road access. And there's also something we actually need that was announced yesterday, and that is more police officers in the community, especially on the TTC, where an employee was stabbed just yesterday. So, do you have anything to say about all this? Do you want to add a story from the place that you are sitting at? The numbers, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome John Burnside, City Councillor for Ward 16, Don Valley East, and former City Councillors Karen Stintz and Rob Davis. Hi, and welcome to you all. Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday, Libby.
Hey, Libby.
Okay. It's happy because we spend Thursday with you, Libby.
Exactly. Oh, that's so sweet, Rob. Thank you for that. So the latest speed camera sign brouhaha, I mean, frankly, it looks pretty silly on both ends to me. Am I missing something here, John?
Well, I think it's more silly in this case than the end of the province. Like what they're, you know, forget the size of the sign in terms of whether you can put it in or not and where, what your space is. What they're saying is that, oh, if we just make signs bigger, everyone will obey the law. Well, then what one would infer from that is that, oh, we need to change all our signs. So maybe our stop signs need to be bigger. Maybe our prohibited left turn signs need to be bigger. I think this is just a fool's game. This is about politics and nothing more.
And what about the contention that Olivia Chow says, oh, now we don't have polls for the signs? And then Pramit Zagaria says, well, you've known how big they're going to be for ages. I mean, is there anything to that part of it?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, we have far more community safety zones than the signs that were sent. But I bet you installing the sign, putting a pole in that's able to bear the weight of that size of sign is far more expensive than the sign itself. So, as I say, this is just both sides playing silly games, but I think it's more on the shoulders of the province. As I say, if it were just a matter of putting in larger signs or signs, maybe we should have really large signs at the LCBO saying, hey, just so you know, please don't steal our alcohol. It's against the law.
That's a good idea. Karen, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with John. You know, I don't know why the province feels the need to send signs as a demonstration that they care about the issue. You know, the whole program got out of control, and I think there was a moment in time when it could have been wrestled back into control and made sense again. But that moment has passed, and so I think now the whole thing just needs to go away. And whether or not Olivia Chow is going to buy bigger poles to accommodate bigger signs, to John's point, because somehow that's going to make a difference in behavior, the whole thing is a bit silly. And it's not really accomplishing much, except now, but the more it goes on, again, the more silly everybody looks.
Well, yeah. And my understanding is that there are in-house carpenters who can make the poles, even though the whole thing seems very kind of low tech, Rob.
Well, and I guarantee you, once those ginormous signs go on the street, the residents are going to complain because yeah. Wherever they're going to go, it's going to go on someone's lawn.
And to your point, Libby, you know, a lot of traffic solutions are actually very low tech. But I think this overall, if I could say this, because, you know, Minister Sakaria is a great guy. He's a very capable minister. I think this has been sort of foisted on him a bit by the premier's wish to kind of get rid of these speed cameras. And, you know, there's a whole regime involved in transportation safety. There's the Highway Traffic Act, which dictates the size of signs, how visible they have to be at distance when you're driving on the road in order for them to be enforceable. And there's a thing called a Transportation Council of Ontario, which also looks at all of these things. There's a large body of work that's done by professionals who say, this is what the standards should be. This has been dictated by politicians, and that's why we're getting it mucked up. If the politicians would stand down, put down their swords, turn them into plowshares, let the professionals come up with a solution or an alternative solution to the speed cameras, we'd have a much better resolution. They would look at, you know, if I had a house and this sign was going to be on the front lawn of my home, I'd be a little angry, quite frankly. And I think Karen Stintz is correct. We're going to get complaints from people who say, why have you replaced the little gray box that was in front of my home with this 3-foot by 7-foot or 8-foot or 4-foot by 8-foot sign that now has to reflect and people are going to look at, and kids are going to hide behind as they try to cross the street. These are school zones. So we have to be mindful that just because we're elected officials doesn't mean that we're the experts. And this is a lesson that I learned a long time ago when I came up with a great traffic solution that ended up causing a lot of pain for people. And I think this is the lesson that the minister, the premier, and the mayor have to learn.
Yeah, and there's a more serious thing. You know, you mentioned, Rob, kids hiding behind the sign. But, John, there's a worry that they're so big and high that there will be blind spots, and it'll be hard to see the kiddies that we're supposed to be protecting.
Absolutely. The problem with this initiative, it's a one size fits all. And, you know, if you're out in the country or a rural area, then those signs may be totally appropriate and might, in fact, be helpful. But when you're in the city where everything is very tight and the sidewalk is right there, there's probably 100 other signs telling you you can't park, what the speed limit is, what turn you can't make, that I think it just pollutes the environment without having much of an impact. And as I say, the dimensions of our city streets and all that's going on, it just seems like a fool's game.
Yeah, I will say yes, a fool's game. I'd like to turn now to a couple of local things that we tried to check, that I asked our producer, Zeev, to call counselors' offices, because we've been getting questions, full disclosure, from me, because they affect me, but also from a lot of other people. These are very practical issues, and there was one that involved where we work here in Liberty Village, and another near my home, which is a little further north in Midtown. So here are the two things. And here in Liberty Village, I had asked Traffic Services, there's almost no way to get out of Liberty Village at rush hour, which is 3 to 7, because left turns are not allowed. They're allowed when Dufferin is open, which is not all the time. They're allowed on Dufferin, and they're allowed on Bathurst, and both of those streets are very congested, and they're very far apart. And previously, when Duro Street was closed, they let you turn left on Sudbury. And now I read that Duro Street, and I don't know why, is going to be closed for several years. And so we reached out to Osma Malik's office, because it wasn't just us, it was other people. And the response that Zeev got was, where do you live? And he tried to tell them that this is a media request. I don't know. I'm sure they don't ask where they live if Bell Media calls them. But this raises a whole other can of worms that I've heard from people about, is that even though businesses pay three times as much property tax, well, we don't get the service because we don't vote here. We have these BIAs, but they are paid for by the city that we need action from. So let's deal with that one before I get to the other one. John, what do you think? Am I sort of blowing smoke in the wrong place?
Well, I mean, kind of there are two issues. One is the responsiveness of the counselor's office, and then the issue of the turn itself. So in terms of their responsiveness, I can only speak for my own office. However, that said, I haven't necessarily heard great things, whether you're a resident or a business. Most counselors recognize that if you are a local business, that we have to work probably extra hard to keep you in the area and make sure that you're profitable and everything works for your employees so that you want to stay. Some counselors didn't get the memo, and you can infer what you will regarding Counselor Malik. In terms of the turn itself, some of these things are legacy issues, and they've just never been updated, and no one's had the wherewithal to actually see if the conditions are the same. So in terms of the left turn, it may be because of streetcars and getting in their way and they want to keep them moving. It might be they don't want more traffic coming through Liberty Village, so they make it difficult to get out. And the unfortunate side effect is that those in the village are caught in that web as well.
Well, I mean, it's to get out of Liberty Village. It'll ease congestion here. And you remind me of something that I saw for the first time yesterday. I have seen buses go through the Red Lakes, but yesterday was the first time I saw a streetcar do a big honk and go through a red light. And it was red when the streetcar started. It was quite something. Yeah, it's just very difficult. A lot of counselors are focused on things other than these practical things. Now, here's another thing that seemingly got a resolution this morning, possibly parenthetically. So near where I live, there was street paving, and the top layer of a road was taken off over a month ago. Probably around 6 weeks ago, and it was just left like that with raised manhole covers and all of that kind of thing. It was quite dangerous, and certainly dangerous to a car. No sign of any action. And I asked Zeev to call because a lot of people are miffed. And just by coincidence, it had been on an agenda at a residents association, but we didn't get to it. And the head of our residents association, just totally by coincidence, said she had a call in to Josh Matlow's office. And then I got an email this morning where she said, oh, I drove by and the work is finally done. And I saw a story in the Star about a contractor getting fined because he was 5 years out of date. So that's my next question. I mean, who keeps track if a contractor who's getting paid a lot of money starts a job and just leaves it, even if it's dangerous, Karen?
Well, that's a theme that came up originally with the snow clearing, but seems to be cascading over a number of city services. You know, the leaf bag collection, for one thing. You know, they have a calendar where we take our leaf bags out and the leaf bags don't get picked up until the leaf bag contractor feels like picking them up, which is fine, except that then people take the opportunity to drop all kind of garbage and dog poop bags in the leaf bags. And then that creates a whole other problem. And we've seen it with the snow clearing and that the contractors didn't execute correctly on the contracts and the snow didn't get cleared, but residents were told that it was cleared, even though they could look out their window and see that it wasn't. And now we have street contractors that are not fulfilling the obligations under their contract. So again, it's not a new issue around accountability at City Hall, in that no one, you know, everyone goes to work and gets their task done, but the job remains unfinished. And nobody really seems to be seized with the notion that a job isn't complete until it's actually been done. And you contributing a task to the overall job is not sufficient. And, you know, it really does come from the mayor's office around setting the expectation that we're going to be accountable for getting the actual job done, not just a task. So it's not a new theme. It's been a repeated theme from the parks to the swimming pools to the snow clearing to now the street contractors to now the pickup of the leaf bags. And, you know, we keep talking about it, but nothing's getting done because ultimately I don't think the mayor particularly cares.
Rob, I mean, it seems like a management issue. I mean, there are a lot of other things that the mayor is seized with, certainly going to events and marching in parades and dressing up, but things that are ideological, frankly, whether it's her or Asma Malik, who's a deputy mayor. And, you know, in St. Paul's, where I am, Josh Matlow, I mean, paving a road is not going to get him airtime on television.
No, well, you know, paving a road is not performative, and you know, news media don't cover those things. I want to cover both topics, though, like really briefly. The concept of asking where you live is endemic of the structural problems. In the old days, business owners could vote because they paid a business tax directly to the city, and that was eliminated. So business owners were able to vote in municipal elections, and when they were no longer able to vote, then they were cast aside, almost as much as tenants are cast aside by councils because they know there's a low voter turnout. So that's a structural problem. The second thing is, you know, back when I was coming up in politics, there was a saying, never pick a fight with somebody who buys ink by the barrel, paper by the ton, and I would also add, who broadcasts using an antenna to hundreds of thousands of people in your city. So I'm surprised that was the question that was asked of Ziv, and I'm hoping that's a lower tier worker not realizing who Moses Neimer Media and Zoomer Radio are, that they made a mistake and that's not the norm. But I'll also say this: the we have to hold, as citizens, as residents of Toronto, we have to hold our elected officials accountable, and those people then have to hold the management accountable for managing those contracts. And so having a ratepayers association, making the phone calls, sending emails, those things matter. So, you know, there's a saying about on the TTC, if you see something, say something. That also means for people who are driving on a street, walking on a sidewalk, or walking through a business community or a BIA. If you see something, make the call, make the complaint, hold them accountable.
Okay, well, and thanks for that. But you know what? Aside from being a media with a transmitter, as you point out, we're a business here. So, you know, you shouldn't have to pull a don't you know who I am, though in this case it was a media call. We're transparent about that. I'm going to take a couple of calls here. We've got Babs in Toronto. Hi, Babs.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for taking my call. The thing is, what the, oh, both politicians, the federal, the Ontario
their
one,
city.
As well as the city, we have deep pockets. They can just dip into it, change whatever they want. You can't do that with your own home. But yes, they'd make a mistake. They just take it out, put it in. The same thing goes for, they keep saying affordable housing. Affordable housing for who? The city, the people that live there? They're just taxes on top of that and tax. So why would somebody want an affordable housing if you're taxing them beyond? And then you're also taking out those signs. And I live by St. Mary's Church. That's a one-way coming in. It's like a roundabout. They are supposed to go one way, but they should have a lot of cops there to see what's going on. They come the opposite way. We have two schools in the area, and that's the public school as well as the Catholic school with little kids. And when the cars come on the opposite side, the guys give you the finger. So I don't understand why they're going on about the signs and they can't see what exactly is going on.
Thank you for that. Let's go to Helen in Toronto. Hello, Helen.
Hi, Libby. Why are those contracts not stage contracts? In other words, you go from point A to B, and you get paid for A to B. You don't go there within the time limit, then there's a penalty to pay. Businesses don't conduct themselves as the government does. That's why businesses do stay in business, most of them. Because you've got an obligation to me if you're going to get my money.
Well, I don't know how they work in terms of the payment. And contractors starting jobs and then, you know, disappearing for a good long while, if not forever, is a problem throughout. John, can you give us any insight on how those contracts read? I know that when people were complaining about the lack of a finish of the paving job, they said that they were told when they saw workers there, they were told, oh, that's another crew.
Yeah, so they generally use different crews because it is less expensive. So they'll have they'll put a whole bunch of contracts in an area, they'll do the scrape, they'll do the rebuild, and then once all that's done, then another crew will come in and pave the various areas, which is more cost effective. So that makes sense. Normally, the contracts do have a timeline associated with them, and there normally are penalties. Now, one of the problems that the city has is that we're supposed to oversee a lot of these contracts and these job sites. And I think that's where a lot of the process falls down, is that we're not doing a good job of holding people accountable. But that's a problem in the city. We don't hold ourselves accountable. So how are we going to hold others accountable?
Yeah, good question. I always try to end on something positive, and it's not entirely positive. Very disturbing news yesterday about a TTC employee stabbed at Dundas Station. There's been, over the last few years, increasing violence on the TTC. But yesterday we learned that there also will be more cops there. I think that's a good thing. Karen?
I think it's a good start. I think it becomes a good thing if they're actually going to intervene and do something about people that are creating disturbances on the system. And there has been a reticence since COVID to address the disturbances and the goings-on that are happening on the TTC that are unrelated to travel. And people continue to treat the TTC as if it's a shelter system or a place to use drugs or, you know, all kinds of social disintegration is happening on the TTC in plain sight. and for all the programs and outreach, people continue to be able to behave that way on a transit system, which is intended to get people from A to B. And so it's great to have the police presence there, but now there needs to be action. And it's not mean, it's not cruel to have someone exit the system that's using it for a purpose that it wasn't intended for.
But that's Rob, not happening what do you, right now. No, it's not so, happening.
Well, I have a very personal sort of perspective on this. In May of 2008, I was a witness to the very first shooting on a subway train in Toronto, and that happened at the Spadina subway station, not too far from where I used to live in Midtown, like you. And I have to tell you, it was traumatizing. It took me months to be able to ride the subway again, and it's taken me years to not look over my shoulder every single time I go through Spadina subway station. You know, in 1995, the very first homicide of a transit employee occurred at Vic Park Station. And that was Jimmy Trocheski. He was killed during a robbery at Victoria Park Station. And so our transit staff, as a former vice chairman of the TTC, their safety matters tremendously to me. The effect that this has on ridership, the effect that it has on riders, it's really important that we dig deep and try to make sure, as Karen says, that if the police are going to be on that subway line, that they actually intervene. And earlier I talked about, if you see something, say something. You know, I've reported lots of folks, some of them unfortunate souls who are in poverty or seem homeless, trying to get the TTC to come provide them with some help. And I've been met with, let's just say, a little bit of some roadblocks from time to time, because the technology to report these things doesn't work when you're underground or in a tunnel. So you could say, hey, I'm on train X, please see if this guy needs help. And they ask you to use the app. And I said, well, the app doesn't work underground. And they said, yeah, you got to wait till you get off the train to let us know where that person is, who's in help, who is in need, is actually located. So there's a lot of gaps.
I thought they fixed that. We're out of time, but I thought they fixed that.
For another show, we'll talk about that.
Okay. For another show, there's always a lot to talk about here. And thank you so much, Karen Stintz, John Burnside, and Rob Davis. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Thank you. Okay, we're taking a break. And when we come back, I bet your inbox is full of Black Friday deals. And Black Friday, I think, is tomorrow. But in my inbox and everywhere else, it's been going on for weeks. And especially when it comes to travel deals, it's a good day to talk about that, because south of the border, it's the biggest travel day of the year. So we'll try to figure out, are those hot Black Friday deals really good deals when we come back?
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, it is American Thanksgiving today, the busiest travel day of the year south of the border. And with many of us thinking about winter travel, especially given today's weather, I bet our inboxes are full of Black Friday travel deals. And Black Friday, of course, is tomorrow. But my inbox certainly has been overflowing with it for weeks. So are these supposed deals really a good deal? We've got some experts to help us sort through that. If you have questions or comments, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Andrea Hegney, independent travel leisure advisor with Direct Travel, and Natalie Preddy, a travel writer. Thank you both so much for joining us. Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, let's begin with Andrea. And Andrea, I have to say that a lot of these things, you'll see a headline, 50% off the flight. And when you drill down on it, it might be 50% off a portion of what you pay. But that doesn't include taxes. It doesn't include whatever surcharges you're paying. And that 50% is actually a lot less than 50%.
Yes, and air is, you know, the most detailed sometimes and the trickiest thing to get that discount on. So that's why you need to work with your favorite travel advisor at Direct Travel to make sure that she's looking at those details and you do get the best promotion that you can.
Mm-hmm. And Natalie, how do you tell a good deal from a not so good deal?
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to hotels and flights, you've got, you know, your 10% off, 20% off. It's minimal. I usually don't jump until it's about 50% off, but I've seen some amazing ones. I know I was looking through Expedia's hotels the other day, and they've got places in Cabo like Nobu and Paradisus and Me by Melia, and they're at 70% off for a night, which is phenomenal. So you've seen somewhere that would be like $1,200 a night is on sale now for $400. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, that's still pretty expensive for a lot of us. Now, Andrea, I know in the past that even when I've seen a deal, I do call the travel advisor, and we want to give some advice to people, however they choose, to book their travel. But again, do you have to do the math? Like, which kinds of properties would actually be offering a good deal now? Is it places that just haven't caught on?
Oh, no. I mean, what I want to say firstly is that the excitement of Black Friday is great, and saving does make us feel good, especially before the expensive holidays. But some of the best deals are had when you're booking early. And so if you do have someone that you work with, if you can give them a hint, I'm interested in going to Cabo this year to this luxury property, then they can watch the sales over time and have you in mind. But if you're grabbing the Black Friday, I wouldn't want to pinpoint, you know, one name brand over the other, because I do sell everything, to say they've got a better deal today. I'd say book early if you don't like the pressure of the Black Friday. But if you do like something closer to last minute, this is wonderful.
I'm always wary when something is presented as like, you got to do it in the next 10 minutes. It feels a little pressury and scammy to me, Natalie. And I usually find that it's like, hey, will this still be here for me tomorrow? That usually it is, right?
Yeah, and you know, to Andrea's point, you know, you booking a ways out is always helpful. You know, the further out you can book, the better. And of course, yes, watching deals, watching price deals are fantastic. And I would actually say that when it comes to Canada, our deals aren't quite as drastic as you'd see in the States. I guess they just have so many more people down there buying all of these deals. So when it comes to travel, I'm the exact same way. The minute there's pressure on me to book now, I don't want to, just to prove a point. But yeah, I think as long as you have someone keeping an eye out on those prices for you, you're okay. But you know, there are some where, yeah, it will be, you know, for wherever you're planning on going, whatever property that may be, whatever brand that may be, you know, there are some deals that will be here. But then of course you're going to have Boxing Day deals, and then there's going to be another deal. So you know, I think ultimately, if you are planning on going somewhere, you just let your travel advisor know ahead of time, and they will help you find the best price for you.
Is there any truth? We keep hearing that, say, in terms of flights or certain things, there are certain days of the week that are better. I think it might be a Tuesday or something. Is there anything to that, Andrea?
I don't think that's a hard and fast rule. I think that it depends on what time of year you're going and where you're going. And so, and you know, air is the most volatile with the pricing. It changes the most often. And so when we're looking for someone, like we're working into 27 and 28 for some cruising and some larger luxury land and getting well ahead, we can't even look at air. So sometimes you need to make your decision and then just watch for the air, and but having someone on your team, you know, having your back to monitor it and make sure that you did get great value. That's the important part.
Natalie, you mentioned these deals for luxury properties in Cabo. And the other thing I find is that if I'm just noodling around on my own, I'll put on the dates that I want to go. And then they pop up at totally different dates.
Yeah, I mean, you do find that, unfortunately, a lot of places will have blackout dates and will say that, you know, you have to book it within this time. There's lots of small print. So I always say you want to read the small print before you book anything. When that comes to, you know, you're signing up for a travel credit card and it says that it includes A, B, and C. Okay, but what's the small print around those? So always check the small print, just because there'll be so much hidden in those little letters.
And Natalie, you mentioned Cabo. Have you seen anything else that you can give us a heads up about that maybe we should check out?
Well, I just know I've seen, you know, quite a few different press releases come into my inbox of different Black Friday sales. And I know that the Expedia Group, and I don't work for them or anything. I just, you know, I have just seen that their prices, and again, it's because they are an aggregator as well, but a lot of their prices have been really, really good. So for instance, I'm looking for somewhere in February in Cabo, looking to, you know, bring a bunch of girls together from all over the country. And I was just having a peruse through what they may have, and I did see 50 to 70% off. And for me, that is something that's going to make me actually stop and, okay, well, let me think about that. And then there are also they are refundable as well. So again, not all of the prices that I saw on Expedia, VRBO, hotels.com, that they're all part of the Expedia group. Not everything I saw there was refundable. So I was, again, like you, I know I don't want to be pressured into something, but where I do have the option where it's fully refundable up until a week before or something like that, I am comfortable booking that and taking advantage of that price and locking it in, knowing that if I need to, I can then refund it, have it refunded.
Andrea, what about destinations? Like, I'm thinking like Jamaica, they had that horrible hurricane. Maybe some of them are back up and running. If you are willing to go to somewhere that has just cleaned up after something bad, is that a good way to get a deal? And do you know, are they up and running?
Yeah, so we have a very close relationship with the Jamaica Tourism Board for our agency. And of course, we've been on a lot of webinars, you know, to educate ourselves. We have, as best we can, up to the minute, you know, each hotel chain has been putting out their press releases so we can keep up. Some of them have totally lost properties. I know Hyatt lost a few, and some of them have just had minor damage. You know, I've been watching Sandals and Beaches, of course, Couples Resorts and Palladium, things, big brands like that. I have clients who are doing humanitarian efforts right now because they really want to jump in, and yet they're going to catch some sunshine and feel good about themselves. I have clients who have stuck with their Jamaica bookings for the winter, and some that have moved on because it won't be the exact same experience that they purchased. And I think it's just important to keep their eyes as well as mine on the news, see how the progress is. And we have great relationships with our BDMs, our development managers for each brand, so that they can give us live up to date. And that's part of our, you know, fees that we charge as travel advisors, is to do the research, to have the relationships, to make sure that we're keeping our clients informed. I wouldn't hesitate to continue to experience Jamaica, but you have to understand that it's not the same as it was in certain parts. And so it's just about doing the background work.
Okay, and finally, to wrap things up, Natalie, what's your advice? Should people jump on a great deal tomorrow, the actual Black Friday, or, you know, take a deep breath?
Well, you know what? I think if there's a deal and it looks good and there, you know, it meets your personal criteria, absolutely jump on it. I think it's a case-by-case basis. You know, if you look at something, you put in your dates, and it's still the same price, go for it. You know, you only live once. And, you know, we get to travel. Make sure you have your travel insurance, because, again, you never know what's going to happen. But I also want to highlight, and, you know, into what Andrea was saying as well. You know, my family is Jamaican, and we just have to be so cognizant of where our tourism dollars are going and how we spend them as well. So when it comes to booking things this Black Friday, just, you know, let's make sure that we're all contributing to sustainable tourism and responsible tourism.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up, thinking about warmer climates. Thanks so much, Andrea Hegney and Natalie Preddy. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for having us.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
We're taking a break. And when we come back, we're still going to be talking about Black Friday from a different point of view. You know, intergenerational gift giving and gift buying. What is hot on the lists this year, and what should we do about it when we come back?
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, what to buy for the younger people on your list? They often have different ideas about what's beautiful and what is cool, which is why demand for gift cards is expected to grow this holiday season. Not to mention that some people see them as inflation-resistant gifts. I mean, after all, okay, a $25 gift card is still $25, even if the giftee, if the recipient, is able to buy less with it. So I don't know how you really square that circle. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free, 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Lucas Arender, who is a writer with The Peak, which did this research on the gift cards, and Bruce Winder, a retail analyst and author. Hi, both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having us on.
Okay, well, let us begin with Lucas. So were you surprised that gift cards are so popular this year? I mean, there have been some problems with them.
Yeah, I think gift cards are always a popular gift. I mean, I think anyone that's celebrated in the holidays knows that. But I think what's different this year is that more Canadians are just planning on spending less in general. And I think gift cards kind of scratch two itches. One, like you mentioned, it's a bit of an inflation hack for some people, because gift cards always cost what they cost, even if for the person getting it, they can't buy as much with it. But on the other hand, it kind of offers them a better picture of how much they're going to spend. If you buy 10 gift cards, you know exactly how much you're going to spend. Whereas if you have a list of all these items, inflation, all these other factors can really drive up that spending pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But Bruce, a couple of things. First of all, I forgot to look up. I was going to look up the number attached to unclaimed gift cards. And it's huge, right?
Yeah, there is. I don't have the exact percentage, but there is quite a bit of gift cards that sort of stay in people's top drawer and don't get spent. The other issue people are a little nervous about with gift cards are the theft side of it, the crime side of it, because they've been in the news a lot over the last couple of years where thieves have sort of changed the back of the gift card or hacked it. So even though the percentage is very small, it still kind of made people think twice about using gift card as a gift vehicle.
I was going to ask about that as well, Lucas, because there have been lots of stories about the gift cards and people, you know, you see them online and they're holding up a gift card that's worth nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what's interesting is a lot of people are buying these gift cards digitally now, right? Like you used to go into a store and buy a few of them as presents. And the majority of gift cards now are being bought digitally, which I think also opens people up to potential scams and some problems in that area as well. But despite this, they do seem to be a very popular choice for particularly young consumers, actually. They're buying gift cards for their peers, for older people in their lives, and they still remain an incredibly and actually an increasingly popular choice for holiday gifts.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, younger people tend to be more trusting of things that they get online. But again, I mean, I hesitate on gift cards just because I've had a number of them that I know were never cashed, and that annoys me. But what are you going to say to the person? Hey, come on, Bruce.
Yeah, gift cards are really efficient. I mean, that's the upside. We just bought a gift card this morning because my sister's 65th birthday is coming up. I don't know what to get her, right? But I know she loves HomeSense. So I just went out and got her a gift card from HomeSense. So, I mean, they're really convenient. They save you a ton of time and worry. And you kind of push, you know, sort of the gift side of it to the receiver, which is good. So there's still a major vehicle that's used. I know one company, I forget who it was, they innovated a bit. They put their gift card in some type of laminated wrap, and it makes it harder for thieves to sort of sabotage the physical gift card at the store level.
The other question I have, and maybe call me old-fashioned, but for years and years, we would always, excuse me, strike out the price of something. And the idea was that the recipient was not supposed to know how much you spent. But with a gift card, obviously, they know. I mean, is that not a thing with younger people, Lucas?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that that's as much of a concern. Like I said, I think people are generally trying to spend less, and I think the concern over people knowing how much you've spent on that gift, particularly with a gift card, is less of a concern. But I do think that there's a bit of a transition into gift cards becoming, I think there's a stigma that they could be a little impersonal, but I think younger people in particular are seeking out gift cards, whether that's at a local restaurant or a local business. Most of them, if you call up, even if they don't advertise it, will give you a gift card. So they don't all have to be an Amazon gift card or something along those lines. And I think people kind of appreciate that personal touch a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah. It doesn't seem that personal to me, Bruce.
It's not as personal as buying a gift for someone, but you know, the chance of you being wrong on the gift is pretty high too, right? That's the problem, is that you show up with something and the person just doesn't like it at all. You know, you miss the mark big time, and gift cards kind of take that away. So you're right, it's less personal, but it also reduces the risk of buying something that's just not good that the person likes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And I've had blowback if I didn't pretend to like something well enough. I don't know. Is that a thing, Lucas?
I mean, I think that's always a thing. You always have to fake a smile from time to time. But I do think, like Bruce said, the gift card is always a safe bet, especially if you're buying for someone that you may not know as well, or even a distant family member. I think it's always a safe bet in that regard. It's never going to be as personal as, you know, a gift you buy for your closest loved ones, but it does certainly have a place still.
And while we're talking, Lucas, so beyond gift cards, is there anything that is the gift of the year for, say, Gen Z?
Yeah, one thing that kind of came up when we were researching this story is just in general, people are getting more creative with their gifts. Again, all in this pursuit of spending less money. People don't want to spend money they don't have. People are already taking out credit card debt to go buy their holiday presents. So people are getting more creative. And one thing that we saw was almost half of Canadians are expecting to give a DIY or a homemade present this year, which is really interesting. And on top of that, also people are looking at secondhand and resale items. So going to, whether that's a vintage shop or somewhere where you might spend less on something that, you know, a loved one would still really appreciate, but just might not break the bank in the same way. So these are some of the things that, I think we're going to see this holiday season for sure.
And what type of things would be a resale item as a gift?
I mean, it could be anything from clothes to home decor, Christmas ornaments, anything along those lines. Obviously, when it comes to resale stuff, I think in general, unless you're looking at very pricey vintage decor, it generally comes with a bit of a cost cut. So I don't necessarily think in certain categories that it comes with a diminished quality as well. And I think Gen Z and younger people already really like thrifting and hunting for these types of things. So I think gifting them to other people in their lives is a pretty natural transition for them.
Bruce, are older people into that at all?
Yeah, a little less, but still older people are looking. They've discovered, thrifting, making things too. I mean, there's still a fair amount of old people on a tight budget. The thrifting thing is new to them, but they've realized it's much more acceptable in society, and there's no stigma with it now. It's a bit of a badge of honor. So, yeah, you're starting to see some older folks jump on the train, too.
And what about, are people making food gifts and distributing those? And in general, food gifts, or are those just sort of hostess gifts, Bruce?
Well, I think a little bit of both, right? If you're going to someone's house, you know, you might say instead of stopping off and buying some food, I might make it. You know, I might make something. It's sort of nice touch if you have the time. And they're also, you know, making other things too, like crafts and decorations and sweaters and clothing like that too, knitting. So there's all kinds of things that can be made by a person to give to another.
What about Gen Z and millennials? Are they making gifts? Lucas?
Yeah, I think food gifts are also big. Again, like you can make them at home, you can personalize them in your own way. I know at my own family Christmas this year, we're doing homemade food and consumables, and I think that's a really fun way to kind of share with the family and friends. So yeah, I think food is a really great way to, again, not spend a ton of money, not break the bank, but again, personalize something for someone that, you know, you want to get something nice, but you might not be able to spend hundreds of dollars on.
Okay, well, it's always good to hear that people are not going into debt for this. Bruce, I'm going to give you the last word about this Christmas.
I think this Christmas is going to be sort of flat, you know, in terms of sales. There's a lot of caution out there because of our trade dispute with our friends south of the border. There's a lot of layoffs out there. There's a bit of inflation out there. So people are going to be very cautious in their spending this consumer. That's what this the holiday. That's what I would say.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Lucas Arinder and Bruce Winder. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, thank you very much.
Okay. So we're ready to Christmas shop. People, Free for All Friday coming up tomorrow. As always, there's going to be a lot to talk about, and I think we'll still be talking about speed cameras. And that is all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. You can follow us on Instagram or on YouTube, and I'll be back here tomorrow, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.